Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we learn about a mysterious heat-resistant material created in the 1980s but lost when its inventor died in 2011. And we meet the local students trying to revive the recipe. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Alice Daniel. We also talked to arts reporter Donald Monroe about upcoming local theater productions, as well as one of Broadway's biggest hits ever, making its way to Fresno.
And last week, we brought you a story about Ethan Morse, the son of the former district attorney in Merced County, who was the victim of a deadly shooting in Atwater on March 15th. Police recently named a suspect in the case, but no motive. Still, some officials wonder if the shooting was tied to Morse's arrest in a gang-related triple homicide 6 years ago. Reporter Brian Kranz brings us the second part in his series, Two Shootings in Atwater.
When Ethan Morse's father, Larry D. Morse II, was still district attorney for Merced County, he often criticized the sheriff's department, saying it didn't have a strategy to overcome gang violence. Here he is speaking before the county board in 2014.
The district attorney's office has become the county's primary gang suppression department, despite that not being our core mission.
In fact, Morse often used state money to execute large gang raids, sometimes in conjunction with the state attorney general's office. The sheriff's office, he said, had too many open gang homicide cases, including one where three teens were fatally shot at a party over Easter weekend in 2013. That's why he was caught off guard when more than a year after that shooting, detectives told him they'd cleared the case. Here's Morse on Merced's talk radio station, KYOS.
They were already heading to a press conference. We hadn't reviewed it, which is also something that we're not terribly comfortable with on an old case, a cold case.
At the press conference, Sheriff Sergeant Chuck Hale said new witnesses and evidence led them to make three arrests, including one of a suspected Norteño member.
Jacob Tellis, 18, was arrested in San Jose, California.
Hale said Tellis shot Bernabette Hernandez Canella, one of the three teenagers. The bullets in his body were from two handguns, a .38 and a .25. That night, when the Morse family was sitting around the dinner table, 18-year-old Ethan shocked his father.
And he's standing in the kitchen, and he looks and he goes, "They've got the wrong guy, Dad." And I said, "What do you mean they got the wrong guy?" He goes, "He didn't do it." And I said, "How do you know he didn't do it?" And he said, "I was there."
Not only was he there, but he admitted to driving Tellez to the party, and he knew Tellez had a gun.
So that night, I texted one of the detectives and said, "We got a problem with the Tellez case."
2 days later, Ethan told investigators Hale and Eric Macias that he, Tellez, and six other people had been in his dad's Toyota Pathfinder that night.
Every single person on that list will tell you exactly what I'm saying. Exactly.
After Ethan said no gun was fired from his vehicle, investigators Hale and Macias pressed him for more details.
Before you guys went out there, did you know of anybody carrying any firearms on us?
Who? I knew Jacob had one. He showed me before we left.
Jacob Tellez?
Yeah.
But Hale was suspicious about the timing of Ethan's statements.
Don't take this the wrong way, but we've got to ask these questions. Why now? Why are you coming forward now?
I kind of thought I was going to get in trouble for taking my dad's car out to a party that eventually people got killed at. And because we didn't do anything, nobody in my car did anything, so I didn't really think that it was huge for us to come forward.
After nearly 38 minutes of Ethan stressing that he was 100% sure Tellez didn't fire his gun and it was absolutely a .22 caliber, investigators let him leave. But 5 days after they interviewed Ethan, sheriff's deputies arrested him on the Morse family front lawn.
Merced County sheriff's deputies believe Tellez pulled the trigger and Morse drove the getaway car.
With an obvious conflict of interest, Larry Morse recused his office and the state attorney general's office, then headed by Kamala Harris, formally filed the charges against Morse and Tellez. A key part of the sheriff's case relied on a butt dial Tellez made to 911
and was heard discussing the shooting.
4 months later, during the preliminary hearings, Judge Ronald Hansen heard testimony from dozens of people, including some who Morse said were in the car that night. As ABC 30 reported,
One passenger claimed Tellez announced he was going to shoot him, quote, for the hood, and then pulled out a black revolver and fired twice through a rolled-down window. Another passenger said Morse encouraged it by asking, "You gonna do it?" But defense attorneys argue the witnesses were coerced into making those statements.
Other witnesses testified that no shots had been fired from Morse's car, saying Tellez tried to pull his gun, but it got caught up in his seatbelt. But the gun Tellez reportedly carried with him that night, the one that Morse swore was a .22, was never recovered. After 4 days of hearings, Judge Hansen made a highly unusual move. He declared Tellez and Morse factually innocent, meaning he didn't believe there was enough evidence to even charge them with a crime. Here's how Larry Morse saw it.
And if there's anything good to take away from this horrific experience, it's that the system can be fair or unfair to anybody, whether it's a farm laborer's son or the district attorney's son.
While being held without bail on the murder charge, Ethan Morse's family says he lost a wrestling scholarship to a small liberal arts college in Arkansas, missed his grandfather's funeral, and was largely known as being connected to a gang shooting. That's why he sued the sheriff's department, the county, and investigators Hale and Macias, eventually reaching out to attorney Gary Gwilliam in Oakland.
16th floor.
The publicity continued to haunt Ethan, and he always felt that he was going to be, that the gangs were after him.
Last May, a federal jury in Fresno awarded Ethan more than $500,000 in compensation for his wrongful arrest and malicious prosecution. It was enough for him to leave the county, but he stuck around because he'd become a father. Less than a year later, on March 15th, Ethan was shot to death shortly after dropping off his 3-year-old daughter at daycare. Gwilliam says it wasn't random.
I don't have any doubt in my mind whatsoever that his killing was definitely related to his being charged with a crime involving the gangs. I don't have any doubt about that in my mind.
The program for Ethan's funeral shows a picture of him, clean-shaven with a short-cropped haircut parted to the left. He's wearing a striped tie with a light blue shirt under an olive tweed jacket.
That's who he was. That's who he was, with his picture with his daughter. And, you know, he was such a good kid, and just such an unnecessary death, you know.
The photo was taken outside the federal courthouse in Fresno where Ethan won his lawsuit just 10 months before someone with a .45 caliber handgun shot him multiple times at the intersection of Fur and Winton Way in Atwater. Police say 26-year-old Dagoberto Franco Penaloza was the shooter, but why Ethan Morse was killed remains a mystery. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Brian Kranz in Atwater.
As more and more Californians get older and retire, there's a growing pool of people with time and skills that community organizations could put to work. But seniors in the state have a relatively low volunteer rate and often feel isolated. A 77-year-old San Francisco man has found a way to stay involved. He forgets about his arthritis and his cane to do what he loves best, cook for his community. As part of the California Dream Collaboration's Graying California Project, KQED's Farida Javala Romero has this story.
In his small kitchen, Imam Saber holds a butcher knife and trims one of the 30 New York steaks he's laid out on a cutting board.
All my work here for charity. I don't charge anything. And I pay every penny in my own money.
That's his $660 Social Security check, and money his wife, Hawaida, earns from running a daycare out of their apartment in San Francisco. In the kitchen, next to the living room where the kids are, Imam's got two pans on the stove. He says the oil has to be smoking hot before putting the meat on.
It seals the flavor. But if you put the steak in a pan and it's not hot, all the juice come down and you lose everything.
Imam worked for decades as a chef at fancy hotels and a French restaurant. Even now that he's retired and has arthritis, he loves to cook.
Why do you like it?
Because I like to eat good.
Growing up in Cairo, Egypt, he was one of 19 kids. He remembers watching his mother cook big meals with neighbors to share. He says in those days, Men weren't allowed in the kitchen.
No men in the kitchen. Only the ladies. But I only want to break the rule because from 7 years old, I start cooking. I love cooking. And I couldn't stop resisting that.
Imam came to San Francisco in 1969. He's lived in the same flat ever since, recreating that bustling family feel from his childhood. For him, community is number one.
God created us to be around each other and to be human to each other. And that's why you enjoy the life.
For decades, Imam has cooked for people at mosques, schools, and nonprofits. He's the guy that volunteers to bring food for Ramadan, a baby shower, or the Christmas party at St. Anthony's, an organization that feeds the homeless.
What sticks with me the most when I think about Imam is his generosity and his joyful spirit.
Lydia Branston works at St. Anthony's. She says for years, Imam made a delicious Middle Eastern banquet of chicken, rice with almonds, and a polenta dessert with rose water and honey.
And he brings to his cooking and his meals this love of community and this sense of that through sharing a meal with another human being that you build relationship. And it's those relationships that keep us together in the end.
Enough.
Back at Imam's flat, dinner is finally ready. He lays the cooked steaks on beds of rice.
I'm always busy. 50 years here, I'm busy for stuff.
He covers the trays with foil and gets ready to deliver them.
That's it. Here we go.
He says goodbye to the kids in the living room, who just woke up from their nap.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, bye.
A man of purpose, on his way to feed the people.
Hey, buddy. Bye, bye. Everybody.
In San Francisco, I'm Farida Yabvala Romero.
Years ago, a BBC program called Tomorrow's World captivated viewers with a seemingly simple demonstration.
An unconventional way of cooking eggs? Well, this is no ordinary egg.
The camera zooms in on a blowtorch pointed directly at an egg that's been coated in a thick white paste. The news anchor keeps the egg in that direct flame for 3 minutes.
Well, it hasn't broken up at all, and you can see on the front here it's glowing red hot.
Then the intrigue. He turns the blowtorch off, picks up the egg with his bare hand, then cracks it over a glass bowl. What's inside?
The egg hasn't even begun to start cooking.
Broadcast in 1990, this was the first look at a new super fire retardant material known as Starlight. That's light as in L-I-T-E. But its secretive inventor died, supposedly without ever sharing his formula. And now students at UC Merced, like Motaz Dahabra, are joining the ranks of enthusiasts around the world trying to recreate it.
Just figuring out how to make things work when everything's kind of against you. I think that's what I like most about this project.
The inventor was a complete unknown, an enigmatic British hairdresser named Morris Ward, who claimed to have stumbled upon Starlight in his kitchen by mixing common household ingredients.
Science is full of accidents that produced great inventions. Penicillin, Teflon, even cornflakes were all developed through happenstance.
Ward showed off his concoction on TV in the U.S. and the U.K., like in this Dateline NBC segment in the mid-90s, but he was notoriously tight-lipped about what was in it.
You know what it does, but you don't necessarily know how it does what it does.
I'm perfectly happy to say that it is what it is and it does what it does.
And despite supposedly drawing attention from big players like NASA and the aerospace giant Boeing, Ward never made a business partnership or even patented Starlight before dying in 2011. Today, though, the internet is full of amateur chemists offering their own Starlight recipes, because the idea is tantalizing. If a thin coating could withstand a direct flame of thousands of degrees, what could it do for space shuttles, airplanes, or homes built in wildfire-prone areas? That's what captivated UC Merced student Motaz Dahabra.
You could literally spray it on your car, spray it on your house, whatever you want to spray it on to make something that's fireproof. That's one of the biggest applications and selling points for it.
DeHabra is a mechanical engineering undergraduate at UC Merced. He's part of a team of graduating seniors trying to recreate the formula in partnership with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Did you set it up?
You unlocked it?
Okay. I haven't set it up.
DeHabra and his teammates created over 150 different recipes for Starlight. Today, they're putting batch number 62 through the blowtorch test.
Ready?
They've molded it into a little white circle, about a half inch thick. It looks pretty underwhelming, like a doughy, uncooked biscuit.
All right, 3, 2, 1, go.
But under the flame, it's a champ. The top, at nearly 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit, blackens, puffs up, and crusts over, kind of like a marshmallow that fell into a campfire. But the bottom, it's not even 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Can I touch it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like barely warm enough. And it's still soft underneath.
Yep.
The key property is that puffy crust that forms on top. It's called intumescence, and it's a buffer of air that essentially insulates the rest of the material. Lots of intumescent paints and resins are now on the market, though none quite capture the magic of Starlight.
So did you recreate it? Did you make Starlight?
I don't know. Nobody knows what Starlight is.
What DeHabra means is their concoction contains only 7 ingredients so far, of the 21 that Morris Ward had hinted at. But the team is open about what's in it. Here's teammate Christopher Toy.
So we have the normal kitchen cornstarch baking soda, and then we have a gallon of school glue. So all of our mixtures need those.
There are also some gardening and painting supplies, all blended using a kitchen hand mixer. But the students' bigger goal is to develop a rigorous, methodical process for testing Starlight recipes, to make something scientifically legitimate out of Starlight's mysterious, almost mythical history. Because of that mystery, not everyone buys into Starlight. Many scientists believe it's a flat-out hoax. But Thomas Pave says that doesn't matter. He's the engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory who coordinated the UC Merced project.
Looking at this problem is real engineering. It is actual science that is being done right now, and it's not just a fairy tale.
But the story of the original Starlight may not be over. Two companies affiliated with Morris Ward's family now claim to own his recipe, though neither has patented anything yet, and only one has made a public demonstration. Plus, the Boeing company does have a similar-sounding patent, though a representative told me it has no connection to Starlight.
Fire cabinet unlocked, right?
Yeah.
The UC Merced students, they're not too concerned. Motaz DeHabra says there's more than enough room in the market for competition and maybe even collaboration.
We're just increasing the circle, that collaborative circle, which I think might help everybody out.
That circle that could have existed if Maurice had done things differently, you know, in the first time.
I don't blame him. In my opinion, he had really good reasons why he didn't release it. Because something that's really good and useful could always be used for the wrong reasons as well.
These students think their reasons, though, are the right ones. They graduated last Saturday, but they're leaving their methods to next year's class, so hopefully they could come a few steps closer to Starlight. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
That is a fascinating, out-of-left-field kind of story, Carrie. And I understand there's a bit more to it than what you were able to put in the story.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wish I could have gone on for much longer. I mentioned at the end a few companies who claim that they've got the original formula for Starlight. I had conversations with them that I wanted to highlight a little bit. But, I started tracking them down because really what fascinated me in particular was whether Morris Ward, the inventor, whether he really died with the formula and why he would or would not have.
Right. He came up with this invention that held a tremendous amount of potential in the fields of engineering and aerospace. And you said yourself he agreed to lots of TV interviews about it.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't that show he really did want to share it with the world?
I know, it would seem that way. And he reportedly did work for a little while along with NASA, Boeing, and the British government. But apparently he did share samples with them so they could run tests on the material. But simultaneously, he was really secretive. He would only share very small samples. And he allegedly would ask these organizations to try not to analyze the contents just study how the material behaved. And so for why he would be so secretive, you know, by some accounts, it was a question of money. You know, one news article from a few years ago quotes someone as saying he would change his demands daily for how much money he wanted for his formula. But many others have said that really it was that he was afraid of his work being used for the wrong purposes, and that even patenting the material, he was worried that that could result in others being able to duplicate it or find something really similar to it and then weaponize it instead of using it to produce something good, like protecting people from fire and from burning.
So when Ward died in 2011, he had never patented the formula, and he'd never struck a deal with Boeing or NASA or any of the other big aerospace companies that had expressed interest in the material. Does that mean Starlight died with him?
This is where the mystery continues, because there are two companies out there that claim they're carrying on his legacy. So the first I want to talk about is called Starlight Technologies. It's a company based in Texas. The vice president is Nikki Ward McDermott, one of Ward's daughters. She claims she's got something close to her father's recipe. Now, I didn't get the chance to actually speak with her, but I did talk with the CEO of Starlight Technologies, Chris Bennett. And you know, I think the first thing that really became apparent to me is that he very much believes in this mission that Morris Ward originally talked about preventing unnecessary deaths from fire, creating fireproof casings for engines. He's very much driven by this vision.
So is his company working on patenting the material then?
He actually says no, that despite the fact that they have the formula, they're not doing research and development on it, but instead focusing more on outreach to get media and firefighter groups and other organizations excited about what Starlight can do. Here's a quote from Chris Bennett.
The key way forward is publicity and public awareness. The public has a right to know about this technology, and the fact that most people have never heard of it after all this time, and it was big news all over the world in the 1990s, is a real red flag that there's some kind of a problem in our country.
He says one of the biggest obstacles they face in this kind of outreach is people who believed the entire Starlight story is a hoax.
Okay, so if Starlight Technologies wants the world to believe that they can make Starlight, why don't they just show the world they can do it?
That's a great question. This is what Bennett said when I put that question to him.
We could probably do a demonstration on a video on the internet, but I've posted videos on YouTube and then they get zero hits except for the friends and people that I send there. And so I haven't really bothered with that, because until we get an opportunity to demonstrate it on television or something, I don't think it's really going to matter.
He also told me that he feels his company has been blocked from getting onto the market.
Okay, so what about the other company?
So the other company does seem to be doing a lot more work on developing a formula. It's called ThermoShield, and it's based up in Sacramento. And according to CEO Rafael Silva Alfonso, Morris Ward's family sold him the formula after Ward died. Now, one really interesting thing about this is that Alfonso says everyone who's trying to recreate Starlight with household materials, they're on the wrong track. He says that the idea that the Starlight is made of household materials, that it's non-toxic, very easy to make, he said that that was a lie that Ward perpetuated to keep people from figuring out the real ingredients.
Right. And didn't he say that he could feed it to his pets?
Right. He did say that. His daughter has said that. And Alfonso says that's just not true.
Yeah, he was very, very secretive about it. And he also liked to play jokes on people. He was just like that. But neither PVA glue or baking powder or baking soda are in the ingredients. It's not made out of household stuff.
Okay, so how far along are they in developing Starlight?
Well, according to Alfonso, ThermoShield is working on two parts of that process. The first is they're trying to develop an actual scalable material, something that can be produced not just in these small samples, but you know, produced on a large scale, distributed in large quantities, something that can be applied easily to whatever material you need. And secondly, they're working on finding investors. He says they've even approached another company to talk about the patentability of what they've got so far. So when I ask him for his take on this other company, Starlight Technologies, and the formula that they've created, he kind of throws the gauntlet at Ward's daughter, Nikki, who again is one of the executives of this other company, Starlight Technologies.
I challenge Nikki to come up with a demonstration and third-party validated real results. That's the way of moving forward with this.
Speaking of validation and results, ThermaShield has posted a video on their website with what looks like a demonstration of their material, though the details are a bit hard to make out. However, just like Chris Bennett of Starlight Technologies, Alfonso wouldn't tell me what's in his formula, and he said he had turned down a request from the UC Merced students for a sample.
So then there's the question of collaboration. Can any of these companies work together on any of this?
Well, you know, both of these companies say yes. You know, to me in an interview, they'll say, you know, we welcome collaboration. We welcome competition. This is all a way to get to a better product with all of these minds out there. And they've invited these UC Merced students to even call them up and work together. So we'll see if they actually follow through on those promises.
Fascinating material, so to speak.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Alice.
Child abuse has been in the headlines recently with Assemblyman Joaquin Arambula's recent trial. He was acquitted in his misdemeanor case last week. But whether it's in the news or under wraps, child abuse is rampant in the San Joaquin Valley. Today in our studio, moderator Kathleen Schock talks with some of the people on the front lines tackling this devastating problem.
Joining us today are Aurora Ramirez and Luisa Avila Magdaleno, both from the Westside Family Preservation Services Network, as well as Becky Kramer from Comprehensive Youth Services. Thank you all for being with us today. So, Becky, I'd like to start with you with really setting a sort of a baseline for this conversation. So how do you define child abuse?
Well, the law defines it as hitting a child with anything but your hand. You can slap a child on the buttocks with an open hand, not leaving a mark or a bruise. Anything else, if you hit them with an object, if you hit them anywhere else and you leave a mark or a bruise, then it's defined as child abuse. And as a mandated reporter, we would file a CPS report.
But of course, physical abuse is just one form of abuse, right?
Yes. There is sexual abuse. There's emotional abuse. There's neglect. There is medical neglect. So basically, anytime when you're not caring for your child properly and their safety and their health, then that can be a safety issue.
Aurora, I would like to talk a little bit about what's happening with the Westside Family Preservation Services Network. So you direct two resource centers, one in Huron and one in Kalinga, as well as a home visiting program. Tell us a little bit about this approach and how the work that you're doing differs from some of the what we think of as more traditional approaches for dealing with child abuse.
Luisa runs our Huron Neighborhood Resource Center. I'm in charge of our Kalinga Neighborhood Resource Center, and my colleague or our colleague, Jaime Arteaga, is in charge of the home visiting program. I think one of the things that differs us from a lot of organizations is that the staff that we have, the majority of them are from the community, so they know the community and a lot of the needs for the community. So it's easy for recipients of services to come in, and they already, it's easier for them to engage, and they already, they're trusted community members, so right. it's easy for them to come in.
So, Luisa, tell me a little bit about the work that is happening at the Neighborhood Resource Center. What kind of services are you providing the community?
Oh, yeah. We provide services such as translations of documents for the families. We do parenting classes. We offer classes for victims of domestic violence. We provide food distributions a month for the families. And then we also offer peer-to-peer counseling, case management with the families. And then we also got the new program, the HBIP program, CalWorks, that we're going to be working with families, specifically with moms that are going to be having new babies or that are going to be new moms.
So taking a proactive approach to engage in family with families before there's a situation of abuse or neglect.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And why is that proactive approach so important, particularly here in the Valley?
Mm-hmm. I would say it's really, really important because that way we can make adults aware of the importance of interacting with the babies, caring for the babies, getting their basic needs met. That way they're able to regulate their emotions when they're getting older and have a better relationship as parents with their kids. And then their kids will be able to have better relationships with other peers as well.
Great. Becky, tell us a little bit more about Comprehensive Youth Services and some of the work that you're doing to address this issue.
We have a number of programs. So we also have four neighborhood resource centers, one in Sanger, one in Selma, one in Reedley, and one located at our main office. We also have clinical therapeutic programs for children of all ages and their parents. And then we also do supervised visitations for those parents who are court-ordered to see their child in a safe environment. We provide that safe environment for those families.
So you've been engaged in this work for many years.
Yes.
Have you seen an increase in abuse?
There has been an increase in reporting abuse. I think that we are becoming more informed and more knowledgeable about what constitutes abuse, but I think we still lag behind in recognizing it and then assisting in those areas. If you look at the history behind child abuse, there was an SPCA, there was laws against cruelty to animals before there was laws against child abuse. And they had to use the laws against the animals, abuse to animals, to do the first child abuse case.
That is staggering.
Yes. And I think that we still, if you watch the news and you watch the coverage, you're still seeing more about animal abuses than about child abuse. And child abuse is much more frequent.
Aurora, talk to me a little bit about the feedback that you get from the families that you work with. What are the situations that you're hearing about, and how are people responding to the services you provide?
I'll use our parenting class as an example. A lot of our parenting class participants talk about the neglect that they have with their children, and they find that out through the parenting class because this is how they were raised. So they don't feel there's any type of neglect going on or any abuse because that's their culture. In their culture, they don't see anything wrong with how they're treating their children. So I guess they tell us that having the parenting class is a blessing for their families because they have better communication with their children and with everyone in their families. And at the end of every parenting class, we have a graduation and we have a ceremony with their family and with their friends. And their friends and family talk to us about the change that they've made in 13 weeks and 13 sessions. And they want to participate in it because they see the difference that this has made in their life.
Wonderful. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm here with Luisa Avila Magdaleno from the Westside Family Preservation Services Network. Tell me a little bit more about what some of the root causes of this behavior are. Child abuse is such a difficult topic to discuss. It can be so devastating for the life of a child and for families in general. Mm-hmm. What in your mind are some of the things that lead people to engage in abusive behavior?
As my coworker mentioned, like maybe a culture plays a big part of it as well. If that's something that happened to them as a child, then they might continue to do it because it's a cycle.
Becky, what are some of the other causes?
Yeah, I think it's stress. It's not knowing how to handle certain situations. I think there's a lot of parents with really great intentions of wanting to teach their children responsibility, but have misguided views about how to do that. There's also, you know, substance abuse, drugs, alcohol, prescription medications. There is family values. There's a lot of families, again, the culture that says, you know, this is okay, and I was raised that way, and I turned out okay. It can be anything. And I think it's just a lack of information and a lack of knowledge of what to do and how to do it differently. And that's why it's so important that parents and people support parents getting into systems that help train them on better disciplinary efforts.
And what is your counsel to parents about discipline as opposed to abuse?
Mm-hmm. There's many ways of disciplining a child. Every child is different. So it's not like you just say, okay, you do X, Y, and Z, and you're good. And you can have one child and one family that needs to be disciplined in this way and the other a different way. So it's really important to understand the child, what motivates them, what encourages them. Obviously, we want more positive parenting. We all do better when people praise us than when they criticize us and they tell us what we're doing wrong. We do better when we're told what we're doing right. And so that's one way of helping parents learn. It also is something that not any one parent can know everything. If you think about all the things that parents need to know, you don't know how to teach your child about education, about just personal safety, about internet safety, about bullying, about drugs and alcohol. It's really difficult for one person to have all that information, all that knowledge. So it's really important to build that support system for parents.
What advice do you have for the community when it comes to recognizing signs of child abuse and when to know when it is appropriate to make a report?
Anytime any person feels that a child can be in any type of danger, they should report, because they should report that there is some type of abuse to authorities, to a CPS worker, because then they will investigate. It is their job to find out if something is wrong with the child. And unfortunately, sometimes the community doesn't want to be involved because they don't want to be a part of gossip, or they don't want to think that they did something wrong. But in reality, if there's not a problem, nothing will happen. Sometimes we have a gut feeling about things. It's important that we report, even if we're not mandated reporters, because you can be saving a child's life. You can be helping a child if they're going through any type of pain.
Becky, I see you nodding. What advice do you have to the community in terms of helping to play a proactive role in protecting children?
Well, I think, as Aurora was saying, is being a participant, taking a role in it. And if you see something, if you see marks or bruises, if you see something that looks suspicious, it can be the child's withdrawing or they're acting out. So you may have a kid that's normally really good in class, and all of a sudden, you know, they're talking back to the teacher, or they're, you know, misbehaving. That can be a sign that something's not right with the child. So we want to find out what's going on with them and be able to assist them. We get really afraid of getting involved in these kinds of things. But if we don't get involved, this is going to continue. And so we really need to make sure that we are stepping up and taking every part that we can in protecting our children.
When we think about child abuse, it is such a difficult topic, and it's such a personal topic. It's something that happens behind closed doors. And it can feel a bit overwhelming in terms of preventing or addressing it. But there are tactics that are making a difference, that are moving the needle, that are protecting children. Can you talk about what you have seen in your work, examples of things that have really made a difference?
I would say our domestic victims of violence class have really made a difference in that for child abuse, because parents, now they're more involved. They're able to see what's the difference between a healthy and a not so healthy relationship. And they're able to learn that, and they're able to apply that with their children.
Where are these parents coming from? How are they coming to you? Is it through outreach? Are they being referred?
Oh, some of them have been referred with the county. They've been referred, and some of them already know that they know that we're part of the community, and they come to us for assistance.
Because I would imagine there is a concern that perhaps mm-hmm. the families that you most need to mm-hmm. reach are not connecting.
Oh, yeah. Also, we do outreach. We go to the schools and outreach our services. On our weekly food distributions, we also talk to the parents, the families, and we also provide them with the list of the services that we offer.
What we do is we receive referrals from anybody and everybody. So any of our programs, anybody can make a referral. We'll reach out to the family and contact them. We'll tell them about the services that we have. So that way there's more than one inroad into our program. We also do a lot of outreach. We'll even go home to home in the communities that we serve to kind of get to know the neighbors. And the more they know us, the more comfortable they are with us. And so the more likely they are to participate in our services.
What kind of resistance do you face when reaching out to families? I would imagine you experience some level of reluctance when people may think that you are questioning or challenging their parenting skills.
I have been working in our organization for 11 years now, and I've never experienced it, but I know that staff members have. At one point, I know that when we approach our client, I'll speak for myself, and I know that my staff does, but we let them know from the beginning that we're there to help. We're not there to judge them. We're there to work with them. We want to make sure that they are helped in whatever needs they have. And if we're not able to help them in our neighborhood resource centers, then we try to find resources that can help them. We don't have therapists in our organization. All we can offer is peer-to-peer counseling, but I know that it's important and it makes a difference because a lot of our clients have never talked a lot or talk to anybody about anything that's happening in their lives. And it's very difficult for them to open up because they've never done it. So we also do door-to-door outreach. And here is where we actually know that the community is open to having these services because they're very welcoming. And when we do our outreach, we do it at different hours. Our business hours are 8 to 5 and 9 to 5 in Huron. But when we do outreach, sometimes we do evening hours. If a client wants to meet us after hours because they work long hours, we are in our office sometimes until 8 at night. 9 at night, anything to be able to offer the services to the client. And that's where the trust, where trust is built. And then that's where the word to word passes by and they know that we're there for them.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. Becky Kramer, your work with Comprehensive Youth Services does include counseling work. That is your background, right?
Yes.
Could you speak a little bit to your experiences over the years, your approach that you've taken?
Basically, my entire career have worked in child abuse, whether it's been sexual abuse or physical abuse, neglect, emotional abuse. And it's always been very important to involve the family in the process of treating the child. And so we've got a number of programs that are specifically family therapy programs. And then we have other programs that are like school-based programs, but we'll bring the parents into the process too. It's so important for us to build that trust with the family because there have been times where the child's never disclosed about abuse until they've met with us. And at that point, we have to file a child abuse report. But it's also important that we continue that therapeutic process with that family. And because of the training, the kindness, the compassion of our staff, 99.9% of the families will continue on with counseling even after an abuse report has been filed.
That's remarkable.
Because they know that we're there to help them. That is the whole purpose of everything we're doing. We're not judging them. We get why they may have ended up where they're at, but we also know that they can change and that they could do different things, and they want to do differently. Parents don't say, I want to be an abusive parent. They want to teach their children. They want to have their children grow up to be successful, responsible. They just don't know how to do that, and we let them know that we can help them do that.
That's great. I'm just wondering, what are the common misconceptions that people have around not just abuse, but people who are abusers? Is there a profile that you encounter that people might have that maybe prevents them from recognizing abuse?
There's no profile.
Right.
It can be anybody, everybody. It is, and I think that is, we always want to look for the monster, the person that looks suspicious, and that is not the case. It can be somebody who in every other arena of their life, they're very professional, they're very kind, they're just very sweet people. This is an area that they struggle with in parenting. They don't know how to do it. They come across situations that are difficult and they don't know how to handle, and it gets out of control. So it could be anybody and everybody. And even people who know what the right things are to do don't always do them.
What do you want the community to know? How can the community support you and your work as you're working to protect children?
I would just tell them that everything has a solution. Like there are different resources that they can go and get assistance for whatever problem they have, that they're not alone, that we're there to support them in whatever we can.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and for the work that you're doing in the community.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. It's nearly summertime, which means a whole new season of theater, music, and art to enjoy and possibly distract us from the Valley's soon-to-be oppressive heat. Back with us in our studio today is Donald Monroe, a longtime Fresno arts reporter and creator of The Monroe Review. He's chatting with FM89's Laura Satsui.
So Donald, thanks so much for being here. To jump in, I want to ask about a regular summer theater experience in Fresno that doesn't really guarantee beating the heat, but it's Shakespeare in the Park, usually at Woodward Park. What can you tell us about what they've got lined up?
Well, Woodward Shakespeare really kind of shook things up this season. They decided to put on their first production much earlier than they thought they would. So they did that in May, which is a much nicer time to enjoy Woodward Park, I guess you could say. In fact, the performance that I attended was that night that we had the terrible thunderstorms in Fresno, and so they had to call the show after half an hour. So I didn't get to see the entire Comedy of Errors, but on balance, it's a really good idea because it's hard to get people to go out there when it's 105 or 110 degrees.
And so watching the first bit of Comedy of Errors that you could watch, I mean, was it promising? Definitely something we should all
watch. It was a fun show. And it's a good show to start the season. And what they are doing that is different that's coming up next is they're going to do Richard II, but they're going to do it indoors. So it's not quite Shakespeare in the Park for their second production. Mm-hmm. And Richard II, that is in July. And then they will be coming back with Antony and Cleopatra outdoors again in September.
Awesome. And so shifting to other community theater groups, there's a lot going on in Clovis, Fresno, even Selma. And so what's on your must-see list then out of the myriad of options you have?
There are a lot of things opening. And in fact, this coming weekend is a really crowded weekend. Definitely on my must-see list is Newsies. This is the local premiere of this very popular musical. And that's going to be at Roger Rocca's. And that opens this coming Thursday. And so that's a high must-see on my list. There are some other productions that are fun that are opening this weekend as well. New Wrinkles, which is a Valley tradition, and that's the performers who are all 55 and older. They play for 16 performances, I think it is, starting this Thursday at Fresno City College.
Awesome. And then while looking ahead and talking about theater, I want to mention the big announcement from Broadway in Fresno from a couple weeks back about a show that's coming here in a bit. What can you tell us about this announcement?
Well, if you have really literally been living under a rock and you hadn't heard that Hamilton is coming to Fresno, that will be performing sometime in the 2020-21 season. They haven't told us exactly when. And it's going to be a little tricky to get tickets. You have to basically commit to two full seasons, buy season tickets for two seasons to get the right to buy your Hamilton tickets.
Wow.
But people are very excited about that. I mean, it used to be that a show like this would take 15 or 20 years to get to Fresno. And, you know, it's going to come in five.
Awesome. And then, so also CSU Summer Arts is coming back to Fresno State, which is sort of like part summer school, part arts intensive. And the courses they offer run across many disciplines, from music to dance to creative writing. And then they do a festival showcase for their students to show off whatever they've learned in their two-week classes. So any courses that or performances you might plan on seeing during their festival to come?
Well, they actually haven't released the specific lineup, but usually there are a couple of high-profile dance companies that will perform, and those are always fun to see. I know that they usually have a theater component, so there are theater-like productions that you can see. And I really recommend going to those free student showcases. For one thing, they're free. It's a great value. And they're a lot of fun because these students are really talented. They come over from all over the state and then also from around the world. And so you can just pop in and just see a lot of talent on stage.
Very cool. And then, so you write the Monroe Review. So oftentimes you go and see shows and then you write reviews, you do interviews in advance. And I wanted to point out that you have a travel tab on this website. So summer is often a great time to go traveling. Is there anything that you're planning on highlighting or that you would recommend for people hoping to get out of Fresno and incorporate some arts into their trip?
Yeah, there are actually a number of theater companies that are within pretty easy driving distance.
Maybe 2 hours.
Of Fresno, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people to check out Sierra Repertory Theater, which is in Sonora. It's a great little theater company. And it's surprising to find something that is professional. They use Actors Equity members in their productions. And it's about a two-hour drive, I think, from Fresno. I can make it up there. I just got back from a great weekend in Santa Cruz, and there's a little theater company there called the Jewel Theater Company that has moved into a beautiful new space, and they are also Actors Equity. And you can usually get tickets and see things for like a lot cheaper at these kinds of places than if you just go to the Broadway tours in San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Awesome. And then, so while we're just kind of looking ahead, I mean, what's your take on the art scene lately in Fresno, or maybe what you're looking forward to, just as our quick takeaway before we end this?
Well, there are a couple of must-see titles that I would say that are coming out in the summer. One is Be More Chill, which is a musical that is really popular right now. And in fact, it just opened on Broadway. It was an off-Broadway production, and that opens July 19th at Selma Arts Center. So you'll have this really interesting situation where we will have the same show that's playing in Selma as is playing in New York. Another one to really look forward to, of course, is Louise Mandrell is going to come back in Calamity Jane. She did that role 7 years ago for Good Company Players, and she is bringing it back. So I think people are excited about that. And StageWorks Fresno also has a couple of good productions coming up, including Mamma Mia and La Caja Fall.
Well, thank you. We've been talking to Donald Monroe, longtime Fresno arts reporter, and you can find his interviews and reviews on his website, themonroereview.com. That's Monroe spelled M-U-N-R-O. Donald, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR. Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Carrie Klein, and reporters Monica Velez and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Carrie Klein. And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.